A lone figure walked towards the Temple of Darkness, moccasins whispering on the slick cobbles. One hand was held up, from which thin, delicate chains whirled round and round, the rings at their ends flashing. Thick rain droplets burst apart in that spinning arc, spraying against the face and the half-smile curving the lips. Someone within that building was resisting. Was it Rake himself? Clip dearly hoped so, and if it was true, then the so-called Son of Darkness was weak, pathetic, and but moments from annihilation. Clip might have harbored demands and accusations once, all lined up and arrayed like arrows for the plucking. Bowstring thrumming, barbed truths winging unerringly through the air to strike home again and again. Yes, he had imagined such a scene, had longed for it. What value hard judgment when there was no one to hurt with it? Where was satisfaction? Pleasure in seeing the wounds? No, hard judgment was like rage. It thrived on victims, and the delicious flush of superiority in the delivery. Perhaps the dying god would reward him, for he so wanted victims. He had, after all, so much rage to give them.
Listen to me, Lord Rake. They slaughtered everyone in the Andara. Everyone. And where were you when your worshippers were dying? Where were you? They called upon you. They begged you.
Yes, Clip would break him. He owed his people that much. He studied the temple as he approached, and he could sense familiarity in its lines, echoes of the Andara and Blue Rose. But this building seemed raw, cruder, as if the stone inadvertently mimicked rough-hewn wood. Memories honored or elegance forgotten? No matter. An instant's thought shattered the temple doors, and he felt the one within recoil in pain. He ascended the steps, walked through the smoke and dust, rings spinning, kelix streaming. The domed roof was latticed with cracks, and the rain poured down in thick black threads. He saw a woman standing at the back, her face a mask of horror. And he saw an old man down on his knees in the center of the mosaic floor, his head bowed. Clip halted, frowned. This was his opponent? This useless, broken, feeble thing? Where was Anamanda Rake?
He is not here. He is not even here. I am his mortal sword, and he is not even here.
He screamed in fury, and power lashed out, rushing in a wall that tore tesserae from the broad floor as it ripped its way out from him, that shattered the pillars ringing the chamber so that they toppled back like felled trees, that engulfed the puny old man. Endest Silan groaned under the assault. Like talons, the dying god's power sank deep into him, shredding his insides. This was too vast to resist. He yielded ground, pace hastening, moments from a rout, a terrified, fatal flight. But there was nowhere to go. If he fell now, every Tistandi in Black Coral would be lost. Saemon Kelic would claim them all, and the city itself would succumb to that dread stain. Coreld Galain would be corrupted, made to feed an alien god's mad hunger for power. And so, amidst a broken chorus of snapping bones and splitting flesh, Endest Silan held on. Desperate, searching for a source of strength, anything, anyone. But Anamanda Rake was gone. He had raged with power like a pillar of fire. He had been indomitable, and in reaching out a hand to settle firm on a shoulder, he could make his confidence a gift. He could make the ones who loved him do the impossible. But now he was gone, and Endest Silan was alone. He felt his soul withering, dying under this blistering assault. And from some vast depth, the old man recalled a river. Defiant of all light, deep, so deep where ran the currents, currents that no force could contain. He could slip into those shore streams, yes, if he but reached down. But the pain, it was so fierce. It demanded all of him. He could not claw free of it, even as it devoured him. The river, if he could but reach it. The god possessing Clip laughed. Everything was within his grasp. He could feel his cherished high priestess, so lovingly usurped from the Redeemer's clutches, so thoroughly seduced into the mindless dance of oblivion, the worship of wasted lives, She was defeating the Redeemer's lone guardian. He was falling back step by step, a mass of wounds, a dozen of them clearly fatal, and though somehow he still stood, still fought, he could not last much longer. The god wanted the Redeemer, a more worthy vessel than the one named Clip, which was so venal in its thoughts, so miserable in its hurts. No better than a child burned by neglect, and now all it dreamed of was lashing out. It believed it had come to confront its father, but there was no father here. There never had been. It had believed it was chosen to deliver justice, but the one named Clip, who had never seen justice, did not understand its true meaning, which ever belonged solely and exclusively within the cage of one's own soul. No, the god's need for Clip was coming to an end. This vessel would be given over to Saemon Kellick, no different from all the others. To dance, to lie above the High Priestess and gush black semen into her womb, a deed without pleasure, for all pleasure was consumed by the dying god's own blood, by the sweet Kellick, and she would swell with the immortal gifts 1,000 times, 10,000 times. The sweetest poison, after all, is the one eagerly shared. The god advanced on the kneeling old man. Time to kill the fool. Aranatha's hand was cool and dry in Amanda's grasp as she led him through an unknown realm that left him blind, stumbling like a dog beaten senseless, the leash of that hand tugging him on and on.
"Please," he whispered, "where are we going?"
"To battle," she replied, and her voice was almost unrecognizable.
Nemanda felt a tremor of fear. Was this even Aranatha? Perhaps some demon had taken her place. Yet the hand, yes, he knew it. Unchanged, so familiar in its ethereal touch. Like a glove with nothing in it, but no. He could feel it, firm, solid. Her hand, like everything else about her, was a mystery he had come to love. The kiss she had given him, what seemed an eternity ago, he could feel it still, as if he had tasted something alien, something so far beyond him that he had no hope of ever understanding, of ever recognizing what it might be. A kiss sweet as a blessing, but had it been Aranatha who had blessed him?
"Aranatha!
We are almost there. Oh, will you defend me, Nemanda? I can but reach through, not far, with little strength. It is all I have ever been able to do, but now she insists, she commands."
"Who?" he asked, suddenly chilled, suddenly shivering. "Who commands you?"
"Why, Aranatha."
"But then, who are you?"
"Will you defend me, Nemanda? I do not deserve it. My errors are legion. My hurt I have made into your curse, a curse upon every one of you. But we are past apologies. We stand in the dust of what's done."
"Please."
"I do not think enough of me can reach through, not against him. I am sorry. If you do not stand in his way, I will fall. I will fail. I feel in your blood a whisper of someone. Someone dear to me, someone who might have withstood him. But he does not await us. He is not there to defend me. What has happened? Nemanda, I have only you."
The small hand, that had felt dry and cool and so oddly reassuring in its remoteness, now felt suddenly frail, like thin porcelain.
"She does not guide me. She holds on."
He sought comprehension from all that she had said. "The blood of someone dear. She cannot reach through, not enough to make her powerful enough against Clip, against the dying god. She is not Aranatha."
"Nemanda, I have only you. We stand in the dust of what's done. Nemanda, we have arrived."
Tears streamed down Seerdemin's ravaged face. Overwhelmed by the helplessness, by the futility of his efforts against such an enemy, he rocked to every blow, staggered in retreat, and if he was laughing, and gods he was, there was no humour in that terrible sound. He hadn't had much pride to begin with, or so he had made his pose, there before the Redeemer, one of such humility. But no soldier with any spine left did not hold to a secret conviction of prowess. And although he had not lied when he'd told himself he was fighting for a god he did not believe in, well, a part of him was unassailed by that particular detail, as if it had made no difference, and in that was revealed the secret pride he had harbored. He would surprise her, he would astonish her by resisting far beyond what she could have anticipated. He would fight the bitch to a standstill. How grim, how noble, how poetic. Yes, they would sing of the battle, all those shining faces in some future temple of white virgin stone, all those shining eyes so pleased to share heroic Cyrodiil's triumphant glory. He could not help but laugh. She was shattering him piece by pathetic piece. It was a wonder any part of his soul was left that could still recognize itself. "See me, Spinnok Durev, old friend, noble friend, and let us share this laugh at my stupid posing. I am mocked, friend, by my own pride. Yes, do laugh as you so wanted to do each and every time you defeated me on our tiny field of battle, there on the stained table in that damp, miserable tavern. You did not imagine how I struggled to hold on to that pride, defeat after defeat, crushing loss after crushing loss. So now let us cast aside our bland masks. Laugh, Spinnok Durev, as you watch me lose yet again." He had not even slowed her down. Blades smashed into him from all sides, 3, 4 at a time. His broken body did not even know where to fall. Her attacks were all that kept him standing. He'd lost his sword. He might even have lost the arm and hand that had been wielding it. There was no telling. He had no sense beyond this knot of mocking knowledge, this lone inner eye unblinkingly fixed on its pathetic self. And now, at last, she must have flung away all her weapons, for her hands closed round his throat. He forced his eyes open, stared into her laughing face. "Oh, I understand now. It was you laughing. You, not me. You, I was hearing. Yes, I understand now." That meant that he, why, he'd been weeping. So much for mockery. The truth was, there was nothing left in him but self-pity. "Spinnok Durev, look away now. Please, look away." Her hands tightening round his throat, she lifted him from the ground, held him high, so she could watch his face as she choked the last life from him, watch and laugh in his face of tears. The High Priestess stood with hands to her mouth, too frightened to move, watching the dying god destroy Endestzilan. He should have crumbled by now. He should have melted beneath that onslaught, and indeed it had begun. Yet somehow, unbelievably, he still held on, making of himself a final frail barrier between the Tist Andi and this horrendous, insane god. She cowered in its shadow. It had been hubris, mad hubris, to have believed they could withstand this abomination, without Anamanda Rake, without even Spinnok Durev. And now she sensed every one of her kin being driven down, unable to lift a hand in self-defense, lying with throats exposed as the poison rain flooded the streets, bubbled in beneath doors, through windows, eating the tiles of roofs as if it was acid, to stream down beams and paint brown every wall. Her kin had begun to feel the thirst, had begun to desire that deadly first sip, as she had. And Endestzilan held the enemy back. Another moment, and then yet another. In the realm of Dragnipur, every force had ceased fighting. Every force, every face. Draconis, Hood, Iskar Jarak, the Chained, the burning eyes of the soldiers of Chaos, all turned to stare at the sky above the wagon, and at the lone figure standing tall on the mound of bodies, where something extraordinary had begun. The tattooed pattern had lifted free of the tumbled, wrinkled canvas of skins, as if the layer that had existed for all to see was now revealed as but one side, one facet, one single dimension of a far greater manifestation, which now rose, unfolding, intricate as a perfect cage, a web of gossamer glistening like wet strokes of ink suspended in the air around Anamanda Rake. He slowly raised his arms. Lying almost at Rake's feet, Kataspala twisted in a frenzy of joy. Revenge and revenge, and yes, revenge.
Stab, dear child, now stab, yes, and stab, and stab.
Ditch, all that remained of him, stared with one eye. He saw an elongated, tattoo-swarmed arm lifting clear, saw the knife in its hand, hovering like a rearing serpent behind Rake's back, and none of this surprised him. The child god's one purpose, the child god's reason to exist, and he was its eye, there to look upon its soul inward and outward, to feel its heart, and that heart overflowed with life, with exultation. To be born and to live was such a gift, to see the sole purpose, to hold and drive the knife deep, and then,
it all ends. Everything here, all of them, these bodies so warm against me, all betrayed by the one their very lives have fed. Precious memories, host of purest regrets, but what, above all else, must always be chained to each and every soul? Why, regrets, of course. Forever chained to one's own history, one's own life story, forever dragging that creaking, tottering burden. To win free of those chains of regret is to shake free of humanity itself, and so become a monster. Sweet child God, will you regret this?
No.
Why not?
There will be no time.
Yes, no time. For anyone, anything. This is your moment of life, your birth, your deed, your death. By this you must measure yourself, in this handful of breaths. Your maker wants you to kill. You are born now. Your deed awaits. Your death hovers just beyond it. Child God, what will you do?
And he felt the god hesitate. He felt it awaken to its own self, and to the freedom that such awakening offered. Yes, its maker had sought to shape it. Sire to child, an unbroken stream of hate and vengeance, to give its own imminent death all the meaning it demanded.
Fail in this, and that death will have no meaning at all.
Yes, but if I die without achieving what I am made to do...
The god could sense the power that had lifted clear now, rushing down from this extraordinary Tist Andi with the silver hair, rushing down along the traceries of the countless bodies, travelling the strands of the vast web, down and down, into that gate. What was he doing? And Ditch smiled as he answered,
Friend, know this for certain. Whatever Anamanda Rake now attempts to do, he does not do it for himself.
And that statement stunned this child god. Not for himself? Was such a thing possible? Did one not ever choose, first and foremost, for oneself?
For most, yes, that is true. And when these ones pass, they are quickly forgotten. Their every achievement grows tarnished. The recognition comes swift that they were not greater than anyone else, not smarter, not braver. Their motives, such sordid things after all. For most, I said, but not this one, not Anamanda Rake.
I see. Then, my mortal friend, I shall do no less.
And so that long arm writhed round, twisting, and the knife stabbed down into Kataspala's chest. The blind Tist Andi shrieked, and his blood poured over the packed bodies. Slain by his own child, and the web drank deep its maker's blood. Someone crawled alongside Ditch. He struggled to focus with his one dying and dying eye. A broad face, the skin flaking off in patches, long thick hair of black slashed through with red. She held a flint knife in one hand.
Take it, he whispered. Take it quick.
And so she did. Agonizing pain, fire stabbing deep into his skull, and then everything began to fade.
And the child god, having killed, now dies.
Only one man wept for it, red tears streaming down. Only one man even knew what it had done, Was it enough? Apsalara saw Anamanda Rake pause, and then look down. He smiled.
Go, with my blessing.
Where?
You will know soon enough.
She looked deep into his shining eyes, even as they darkened and darkened and darkened yet more, until she realized what she was seeing, and a breath cold as ice rushed over her. She cried out, recalling where she had felt that cold before. And Apsalara, mistress of thieves, tossed him the bloody eye of the god. He caught it one-handed.
A keepsake,
she whispered, and then rolled clear. For this wagon was no place to be, not with what was about to happen. The pattern sank down through the heaped forms even as the gate of darkness rose up to meet it. Wander no longer. Anamanda Rake, still standing, head tilted back, arms raised, began to dissolve, shred away as the gate took hold of him, as it fed upon him, upon the Son of Darkness, upon what he desired, what he willed to be. Witnessing this, Draconis sank down to his knees. He finally understood what was happening. He finally understood what Anamanda Rake had planned all along. This wondrous thing. Staring upward, he whispered,
You ask my forgiveness? When you unravel what I have done, what I did so long ago? When you heal what I wounded? When you mend what I broke? He raised his voice to a shout. Rake, there is no forgiveness you must seek, not from me, gods below, not from any of us.
But there was no way to know if he had been heard. The man that had been Anamanda Rake was scattered into the realm of Khorald Galain, onto its own long-sealed path that might, just might, lead to the very feet of Mother Dark, who had turned away.
Mother Dark, Draconis whispered. I believe you must face him now. You must turn to your children. I believe your son insists. He demands it. Open your eyes, Mother Dark. See what he has done. For you, for the Tistandi, but not for himself. See and know what he has done.
Darkness awakened, the pattern grasping hold of the gate itself, and sinking down, passing beyond Dragnipur, leaving forever the dread sword. In the Temple of Shadow, in the city of black coral that drowned in poison rain, Clip and the god within him stood above the huddled form of Endest Silan. This game was over. All pleasure in the victory had palled in the absurd, stubborn resistance of the old man. The rings spun round and round from one hand as he drew a dagger with the other. Simple, messy, yes, but succinct, final. And then he saw the floor suddenly awaken with black seething strands, forming a pattern, and icy cold breath rose in a long sigh. The sheets of spilling rain froze the instant each droplet reached the cold air, falling to shatter on the heaved cobbles and broken tesserae. And that cold lifted yet higher. The dying god frowned. The pattern was spreading to cover the entire floor of the altar chamber, swarming outward. It looked strangely misshapen, as if the design possessed more dimensions than were visible. The entire temple trembled. Crouched on a berm at the crest of a forested slope, Spindle and Monkrat stared up at the sky directly above black coral. As a strange maze-like pattern appeared in the air, burgeoning out to the sides even as it began sinking down onto the city. They saw the moment when a tendril of that pattern touched the sleeping dragon perched on its spire, and they saw it spread its wings out in massive, unfolding crimson fans, saw its head lifting on its long neck, jaws opening, and Silana roared, a sound that deafened, a cry of grief, of rage, of unleashed intent. It launched itself into that falling pattern, that falling sky, and sailed out over the city. Spindle laughed a vicious laugh.
Run, Gradithan, run all you like.
That fiery bitch is hunting you.
Aranatha stepped through, Nemanda following. Gasping, he tore his hand free, for her grip had become a thing of unbearable cold, burning, too deadly to touch. He stumbled to one side. She had halted at the very edge of an enormous altar chamber, where a bizarre ethereal pattern was raining down from the domed ceiling, countless linked filaments of black threads slowly descending even as other tendrils rose from the floor itself. And Nemanda heard her whisper,
"The gate! How? Oh, my dearest son! Oh, Anomanda!"
Clip stood in the center of the chamber, and he turned round upon the arrival of Aranatha and Nemanda. The rings spun out on their lengths of chain, and then stopped, caught in the pattern, the chains shivering taut. Sudden agony lit Clip's face. There was a snap as the looped chain bit through his index finger, and the rings spun and whirled up and away, speared in the pattern. Racing along every thread, ever faster, until they were nothing but blurs, and then even that vanished. Nemanda stepped past Aranatha and leapt forward, straight for Clip, who had staggered to one side, looking down, as if seeking his severed finger somewhere at his feet. On his face, shock and pain, bewilderment. He had ever underestimated Nemanda, an easy mistake. Mistakes often were. So like his sire, so slow to anger, but when that anger arrived, Nemanda grasped Clip by the front of his jerkin, swung him off his feet, and in a single ferocious surge sent him sprawling, tumbling across the floor. Awakening the dying god, blazing with rage, it regained its feet and whirled to face Nemanda, who did not even flinch as he prepared to advance to meet it, unsheathing his sword. A fluttering touch on his shoulder stayed him. Aranatha, who was no longer Aranatha, stepped past him. But no, her feet were not even touching the floor. She rose yet higher, amidst streams of darkness that flowed down like silk, and she stared down upon the dying god, who, finding himself face to face with Mother Dark, with the elder goddess in the flesh, quailed, shrinking back, diminished. "She does not reach through, not anymore. She is here. Mother Dark is here." And Nemanda heard her say,
"Ah, my son, I accept."
The gate of darkness wandered no more, was pursued no longer. The gate of darkness had found a new home in the heart of black coral. Lying in a heap of mangled flesh and bone, dying, Endest Silan rose from the river, thing of memory and of truth that had kept him alive for so long, and opened his eyes. The High Priestess knelt at his side, one hand brushing his cheek.
"How?"
she whispered.
"How could he ask this of you? How could he know?"
Through his tears, he smiled.
"All that he has ever asked of us, of me and Spinok Durav, and so many others, he has given us in return. Each and every time, this is his secret. Don't you understand, High Priestess? We served the one who served us."
He closed his eyes then, as he felt another presence, one he had never imagined he would ever feel again. And in his mind he spoke,
"For you, Mother, he did this. For us, he did this. He has brought us all home. He has brought us all home."
And she replied in his mind then, her voice rising from the depths below, from the river where he had found his strength to hold one last time, as his lord had asked him to, as his lord had known he would do. She said,
"I understand. Come to me then. The water between us, Endest Silan, is clear. The water is clear."
As the ruined, lifeless remnant that had once been Seerdemin was flung to one side, Salind prepared to resume her attack at last upon the Redeemer himself. The god who had once been Itkovian, silent, wondering witness to a defense of unimaginable courage, now lifted his head. He could feel a presence, more than one, a mother, a son, apart for so long, and now they were entwined in ways too mysterious, too ineffable to grasp. And then, in a flood, he was made to comprehend the truth of gifts, the truth of redemption. He gasped.
I am shown. I am shown.
And down he marched to meet her.
Thank you, Anamanda Rake, for this unexpected gift, my hidden friend, and fare you well.
The Redeemer, on his barrow of worthless wealth, need not stand outside, need not face darkness. No, he could walk forward now into that realm. Down through the thinning, watery rain to where she stood, uncertain, trembling, on the very edge of abandonment. He took Salind into his embrace, and holding her close, he spoke these words.
Bless you that you not be taken. Bless you that you begin in your time and that you end in its fullness. Bless you in the name of the Redeemer, in my name, against the cruel harvesters of the soul, the takers of life. Bless you that your life and each life shall be as it is written, for peace is born of completion.
Against this the dying god had no defense. In this embrace the dying god came to believe that he had not marched to the Redeemer, but that the Redeemer had summoned him. An invitation he could not have seen nor recognized, to heal what none other could heal. Here in this pure darkness, at the very gate of Mother Dark, there was, in fact, no other possible place for rebirth. The dying god simply slipped away. And Salind, why, she felt soft in his arms. The Redeemer leaves judgment to others. This frees him, you see, to cleanse all. And the water is clear between them. The ashes drifted down upon a still, silent scene. The legions of chaos were gone from Dragnipur. Their quarry vanished. The wagon stood motionless, riven with fissures. Draconis looked round and he could see how few of the chained were left. So many obliterated, devoured. His gaze settled for a moment upon the patch of ground where the demon Pearl had made its stand, where it had fallen, defiant to the very end. He saw the soldier named Iskar Jarak, sitting astride his horse and staring up at the place where Anamanda Rake had been, there on top of the now motionless, silent bodies, not one of whom bore any remnant of the vast tattoo. Draconis walked up to stand beside him.
You knew him, didn't you?
Iskar Jarak nodded.
He called me a friend.
Draconis sighed.
I wish I could say the same. I wish I could have known him better than I did.
He heard someone approaching and turned to see Hood.
Lord of Death, now what? We remain chained. We cannot leave as did the bridge burners and the grey swords. There are too few of us to pull the wagon, even had we anywhere to go. I see, I understand what Rake has done, and I do not hold him any ill will. But now I find myself wishing I had joined the others, to find an end to this.
Iskar Jarak grunted and then said,
You spoke true, Draconis, when you said you did not know him well.
Draconis scowled.
What do you mean?
He means, said Hood, we now come to the final act in this bargain.
He has been true to his word, but now what comes is out of his hands. He wrote a promise, yes, but will that suffice?
Shame on you, Hood, said Iskar Jarak, gathering up the reins. There is not a fool out there who would betray the Son of Darkness, not in this, not even now, though he has left us, though he has returned to his mother's realm.
You chastise me, Iskar Jarak?
I do, the Jaggot snorted.
Accepted, he said.
Barathol sat on the cobbles, feeling as if every bone in his body was fractured, as if every muscle was bruised. He wanted to throw up, but struggled against the impulse, lest the convulsions kill him. He glanced yet again at that sprawled corpse with the sword embedded in its face and skull. He could see the broad, deep puncture wounds on one thigh, where the hound had picked it up. No blood leaked from them. Ansi came over and crouched down.
"Look at what we run into here. There's beast blood everywhere. And you, you damned idiot, you stood down one of them monsters with a damned axe.
Help me up, will you?"
Ansi stared, then sighed.
"We'd need the ox for that. You're big as a bedarin. Fine, I'll squat here and you try using me like I was a ladder, but don't blame me if my knees buckle."
Another carriage had drawn up a short time earlier, and before it stood the high alchemist Baruch, the one who'd turned them away, and beside him a warrior with Bargast blood, an enormous hammer strapped to his back. This one walked up to stare down at the dead Tistandi. Barathol pulled himself upright, Ansi grunting under his weight, and then straightened with a soft word of thanks. He glanced over to study the others still remaining, the Toblachai warrior and the woman who seemed to be his companion. The two other Toblachai, young women, possibly even children, who might have been sisters, and a large dog bearing more scars than seemed possible. Great ravens still lined the roof edges, or huddled like black demonic gnomes on the street itself, silent as wraiths. The dawn's golden sunlight streamed through the smoke hanging over the city, and he could hear nothing of the normal wakening bustle that should have already begun filling Darujistan's streets. Beyond this immediate gathering, others were appearing, citizens, guards, blank-faced and empty of words, none as refugees, none drawing too close but seemingly unwilling to leave. The High Alchemist was standing a respectful distance away from the Bargast and the dead Tistandi, watching with sorrow-filled eyes. He then spoke.
"Caladan brood, what he sought must—"
"Wait," rumbled the Bargast. "It must wait."
He bent down then, reached out and grasped hold of the black-bladed sword, and with little ceremony he worked the weapon loose and then straightened once more. It seemed everyone present held their breath. Caladan Brood stared down at the weapon in his hands. Then, Barathol saw, the warrior's mouth twisted into a faint snarl, filed teeth gleaming, and he turned round and walked to the carriage, where he opened the side door and tossed the sword inside. It clanged, thumped, the door clicked shut. The Bargast glared about and then pointed.
"That ox and cart.
Caladan,
I will have my way here, Baruch."
His bestial eyes found Barathol.
"You help me with him."
Barathol bit back every groan as he took hold of the Tistandi's feet, watching as Brood forced his hands beneath the corpse's shoulders, down onto the arms. Together they lifted the body. Ansi had brought the cart close, and he now stood beside the ox, his expression miserable. They laid the body of Anamanda Rake on the slatted bed with its old bloodstains. Brood leaned over it for a long moment, and then he drew himself upright once more and faced the High Alchemist.
"I shall build him a barrow, west of the city."
"Caladan, please, that can wait. We have to—"
"No."
He moved to where Ansi stood and with one hand pushed the Falari away from the ox, grasping hold of the yoke.
"I will do this. None other need be burdened with this journey. It shall be Caladan Brood and Anamanda Rake together one last time."
And so the ox began its fateful walk, a warrior at its side, the corpse of another in the cart. The procession was forced to halt but once, not 10 paces from where it started, as a short, round man in a red waistcoat had positioned himself directly in its path. Caladan Brood looked up, frowned. The short, round man then, with surprising grace, bowed before backing to one side. Brood said nothing, simply tugging the ox into motion once again. It was said that he had saved Darujistan, once years ago and now again.
the Lord of Moonspawn, who on this night brought darkness down, darkness and cold down upon the raging fires, who somehow crushed the life from a growing conflagration of destruction, saving the lives of everyone. It was said he single-handedly banished the demon hounds. It was said upon the instant of his death the heart of the moon broke, and proof of that still lingered in the sky. Who killed him? No one was sure. Rumors of Vorkon's return fueled speculation of some vicious betrayal, a Malazan contract, a god's blind rage. But clearly it was fated, that death. For did not the worshippers of Decembre emerge from their temple last night? Was that not a time for the Lord of Tragedy? Oh, but it was, yes, it surely was. And so, unbidden, people came out onto the streets. They lined the route taken by Caladan Brood to await his passing, the warrior, the ox, the cart. And when he did, he was watched in silence. And when the procession had passed, the people fell into his wake, becoming a river of humanity. On this morning, Darujistan was like no other city. No hawkers called out their wares, market stalls remained shut, no fisher boats slipped their moorings and set out on the mirror waters of the lake, looms stayed motionless, spindles unspun. And from every temple bells began their toll, discordant, sonorous, building like a broken echo, as if the city itself had found a voice, and that voice, so filled with the chaos of grief, would now speak for every citizen, for the priests and priestesses, for the very gods in their temples. Amidst the clanging bells, great ravens rose into the smoky sky, wheeling above rooftops, forming a caterwauling, grisly escort. At first there were but hundreds, and then there were thousands, swirling in a mass as if drawn to deliver darkness to Darujistan, as if to shroud the body below. And just beyond Warritown, ascending the first of the Gadrobi Hills, a lone swordsman paused and half turned a ravaged face to the fretful music of those bells, those birds, and whatever might have been there in his eyes. Well, there was no one to witness it. And so he set his back to Darujistan and resumed his journey. That he had nowhere to go, at least for the moment, was without relevance. Solitude finds its own path for the one who will not share burdens. And loneliness is no fit companion for the eternally lost, but it is the only one they know. At this moment, another lone figure, clad in chain, sat in a tavern in Warritown. The notion of witnessing the procession in the city was proving too unpalatable. Kalor despised funerals, celebrations of failure, wallowing in pathos. Every living soul standing there forced to stare into mortality's grinning face. No, that was not for Kalor. He preferred kicking that piss-grinning, shit-reeking bastard face right between the fucking eyes. The tavern was empty, since it seemed no one else shared his sentiments, and that was fine with him. It had always been fine with him. Or so he told himself, as he stared down into his stolen tankard of bad ale, and listened to those infernal bells and those oversized vultures, and that chorus was hauntingly familiar. Death, ruin, grief. "Hear that," he said to his tankard. "They're playing our song." Blend walked into Karul's bar and found it empty, save for the hunched figure of the historian, who sat at his chosen table, staring at the stained, pitted wood. She walked over and looked down at him. "Who died?" Dyker did not look up.
"Not who, Blend. More like what. What died? More, I think, than we'll ever know."
She hesitated.
"Have you checked on Picker?"
"She walked out of here a quarter bell ago."
"What?"
"Said she'd be back."
"That's it? That's all she said?"
"Something else. Something about them damned talks."
He finally glanced up, his eyes bleak as ever.
"Sit down, Blend. Please. I don't like being alone, not right now. She'll be back."
At that moment, a bell began ringing overhead, and both Malazans ducked at the deafening clangor.
"Oh,
gods below, swore Blend. Who's up in the belfry?
Dyker was frowning. The only other person here is Silara, I suppose. And then he fell silent, and the wasted misery in his eyes deepened. Blend sat down.
She'd better get tired soon, or I'll have to go up there.
They sat, weathering the clanging. Blend studied Dyker, wondering at his ever-deepening despondency, and then a realization struck her.
I thought we unshipped that bell.
We did, Blend. It's in the cellar.
Oh.
No wonder he looked so wretched.
Plan on cutting off its head? Samardev asked. Karsa Orlong was standing over the hound he had killed. At her question, he grunted.
I could use a kitchen knife to finish the job. See how my blade cut through that spine? Like chopping down a tree.
She found she was trembling, decided it was exhaustion.
They're your daughters, aren't they?
Karsa glanced over at the two Toblakai girls, who stood watching, silent, expectant.
I raped a mother and a daughter.
Ah, well, isn't that nice?
It was my right.
Funny, that.
What?
That idea of rights. The way that claiming a right so often results in someone else losing theirs. At which point it all comes down to who's holding the biggest sword.
I won that right when I killed their men. This was tribal war, which...
He paused. And I was young.
Gods below, you're actually telling me you have regrets?
The Toblakai turned away from the dead hound and faced his daughters.
I have many, he answered, but not these two.
And if they feel differently about it, Karsa?
Why should they? I gave them life.
I think, Samardev said, that I shall never understand you.
She eyed the girls.
Do they know what we're saying?
Of course not. They couldn't have learned any Seven Cities language. I've not seen you speak to them, Karsa. What are you waiting for?
I am waiting, he replied, for when I can think of something to say.
At that moment, another woman emerged from an alley mouth and, gaze fixed on Karsa Orlong, walked over.
Toblakai, she said, I have a message to deliver to you.
She was speaking Malazan.
I don't know you.
Karsa said to her in the same language.
The feeling's mutual, she snapped. But let's not let that get in the way.
She hesitated.
Do you want this message private, or maybe I should just shout it so everybody can hear?
Karsa shot Samardev an amused look.
Did I ever tell you, witch, that I liked Malazans?
Yes,
she replied, sighing.
You need not shout, Malazan, nor will we hide in some corner. So tell me this mysterious message, but first tell me who it is from.
All right. It's from Hood, I think.
Samardev snorted.
Let me guess. Keep up the good work, yours truly.
The Malazan woman regarded her.
Well now, after all this is done, permit me to buy you a drink.
Samardev's brows rose.
The message, Karsa growled.
Right. It's this. You must not leave Darujistan.
And if I do?
Then you will have lost your one opportunity to fulfill a vow you once made.
I have made many vows.
I'm shocked to hear that.
Karsa was smiling, but something deadly had awakened in it.
Will you tell me more?
The woman hesitated again.
I'm reconsidering. This really needs to be private. No offense, witch. He called you that, yes? It's just that...
Tell me,
Karsa demanded. Samardev was impressed to see that the Malazan woman did not flinch from Karsa's dangerous smile.
Toblakai, you will be needed.
To do what?
Why, to kill a god.
Which god?
The Malazan woman stared, discomforted for the first time since arriving.
You were supposed to run away when I told you that. Any sane person would.
Then you found the wrong warrior, said Samardev, her mouth dry. And you were right. I wish I hadn't heard that. I'm going to walk away now, so you can finish delivering your message.
Go to Karul's bar, said the Malazan. Tell them Picker sent you.
Breakfast, decent wine, and if Blend offers to prepare you a bath and maybe soap you down some, be nice to her.
Generous of you, I think.
That's me, Picker said. Samardev set out in search of Kurul's bar. A breakfast sounded very fine indeed, as did the notion of decent wine. As for the bath, well, if it was indeed offered, why, she suspected she'd be too weary to resist. Tens of thousands now followed the ox cart and its burden as it made its way down from Lakefront and into the Gadrobi district. Bells rang, the great ravens wheeled, adding their wretched cries. And already, from the hills beyond Tuok's gate, clouds of dust rose into the morning sky. Caladan Brood did not need to hew each stone or drive spade into stony soil. The Warren of Tennis had been awakened, and the flesh of Burn was given new shape and new purpose. In this chosen place, a hill was being transformed, and by the time Brood led the ox up to the Barrow's passage entrance, and took the body of Anamanda Rake into his arms, the chamber within was ready. And when he then emerged, pausing as if startled upon seeing the tens of thousands of silent mourners forming a ring round the hill's base, an enormous capstone had risen into view, splitting the grassy ground. And when with one hand Caladan Brood had guided it into place, he drew his hammer to seal the barrow forever. Anamanda Rake was interred in darkness, weaponless, accompanied by no gifts, no wealth, no treasured possessions. His flesh was not treated against the ravages of decay. The blood and gore covering his face was not even washed away. None of these gestures belonged to the Tistandi, for whom the soul's departure leaves the flesh blind, insensate, and indifferent. Dying delivers one into the river of darkness, that passes into and out of the ruined city of Carcanus, the womb long dead, long abandoned. Into the river, and the river must travel on, ever on. Caladan Brood sealed the barrow, and upon the capstone of bleached dolomite he set a symbol, carved deep into the stone's face, an ancient Bargast glyph, its meaning precise and yet a thing of countless layers, although this is known only to those who in life come to face it directly. A single Bargast glyph, which said, Grief. When Baruch had vanished inside his carriage and the conveyance had rumbled off on its way to the High Alchemist's venerable estate, when the huge Toblakai warrior and Picker had concluded their conversation, and each had gone their own way, the former trailed by his daughters and the limping dog, when the place where two warriors had met in mortal combat bore nothing but a scattering of masonry, sun-darkened swaths of spilled blood, and the motionless forms of dead hounds of light, when all this had come to pass, two figures emerged from the shadows. One was barely visible despite the harsh sunlight, ghostly, leaning on a cane, and after a time of silence, this one spoke in a rasping voice. To begin with, a single word.
Well,
and his companion replied in kind. Well, the cane tapped a few times on the cobbles. The companion then said, It's out of our hands now, until the end.
Until the end, agreed Shadow Throne. You know, Cotillion, I never much liked Caladan Brood.
Really? I never knew.
Do you think?
I think, said Cotillion, that we need not worry on that count.
Shadow Throne sighed.
Are we pleased? It was delicate, the timing. Are we pleased? We should be.
The damned hounds of light, said Cotillion. That was unexpected. Two, yes, but 10? Gods below.
Humph! I was more worried by my Magus's temporary sanity.
Is that what you call it?
He had a chance, a slim one, but he had a chance. Imagine that one wielding Dragnipur.
Cotillion regarded his companion.
Are you suggesting he would not have relinquished it?
Amanas, really, that was all your play. I'm not fooled by his seemingly going rogue on you.
You vowed you'd not try to steal the sword, but of course you never mentioned anything about one of your high priests doing it for you.
And it would have been mine, Shadowthrone hissed in sudden rage, if not for that confounded fat man with the greasy lips, mine!
Iskarul Pusts, you mean? Shadowthrone settled down once more, tapped his cane.
We'd have seen eye to eye eventually.
I doubt it.
Well, who cares what you think anyway?
So where is he now?
Pust, back in the temple, poring through the archives of the Book of Shadows.
Looking for what?
Some provision, any provision, for a high priest of shadow having two wives.
Is there one?
How should I know?
Well, Cotillion said, didn't you write it? Shadowthrone shifted about.
I was busy.
So who did? Shadowthrone would not answer. Cotillion's brows rose. Not Pust, the Book of Shadows, where he's proclaimed the Magus of the High House Shadow?
It's called delegation,
Shadowthrone snapped. It's called idiocy.
Well, I dare say he'll find what he's looking for, won't he?
Aye, with the ink still wet. They said nothing then for a time, until Cotillion drew in a deep breath and let it out in a long sigh, and then said, we should give him a few days, I think. And this time he was not speaking of Iskarul Pust.
Unless you want to get cut to pieces, yes, a few days.
I wasn't sure he'd, well, accept. Right up until the moment he... Cotillion winced and looked up the street, as if straining to see some lone, wandering, lost figure dragging a sword in one hand. But no, he wouldn't be coming back. You know, I did offer to explain. It might have eased his conscience, but he wasn't interested.
Listen to these damned bells, said Shadowthrone. My head's hurting enough as it is. Let's go. We're done here.
And so they were. And so they did. Two streets from his home, Belam Nom was grasped from behind and then pushed up against a wall. The motion ripped pain through his broken arm. Gasping, close to blacking out, he stared into the face of the man accosting him and then slumped.
Uncle!
And he saw, behind Ralik, another vaguely familiar face.
And, Uncle!
Frowning, Ralik eased back. You look a mess, Belam. And Torvald said,
the whole damned Nom clan is out hunting for you.
Oh.
It won't do having the heir to the house going missing for days, Torvald said. You've got responsibilities, Belam. Look at us. Even we weren't so wayward in our young days, and we're heirs to nothing. So now we've got to escort you home. See how you've burdened us?
And they set out.
I trust, Ralik said, that whoever you tangled with fared worse, Belam.
I suppose he did.
Well, that's something at least.
After they had ushered the young man through the gate, peering after him to make sure he actually went inside, Ralik and Torvald set off.
That was a good one, Ralik said. All that rubbish about us in our youth.
The challenge was in keeping a straight face.
Well, now, we weren't so bad back then. At least until you stole my girlfriend.
I knew you hadn't forgotten.
I suggest we go now to Sweet Tisera, where I intend to do my best to steal her back.
You're not actually expecting she'll make us breakfast, are you?
Why not?
Tisera is nobody's servant, cousin.
Oh, well, you can keep her then.
Torvald smiled to himself. It was so easy working Ralik. It had always been so easy getting him to end up thinking precisely what Torvald wanted him to think. Ralik walked beside him, also pleased, as from the corner of his eye he noted Torvald's badly concealed, faintly smug smile. Putting his cousin at ease had never taxed Ralik. It was a comfort, at times, how some things never changed.
When Sister Spite stepped onto the deck, she saw Cutter near the stern, leaning on the rail and staring out over the placid lake. She hid her surprise and went to join him.
"I am returning to Seven Cities," she said.
He nodded.
"That's close enough."
"Ah, well, I am pleased to have your company, Cutter."
He glanced over at her.
"Get what you wanted?"
"Of course not, and mostly."
"So you're not upset?"
"Only insofar as I failed in sinking my teeth into my sister's soft throat. But that can wait."
If he was startled by her words, he did not show it.
"I would have thought you'd want to finish it, since you came all this way."
"Oh, there are purposes, and there are purposes to all that we do, my young friend. In any case, it is best that I leave immediately, for reasons I care not to explain. Have you said your goodbyes?"
He shrugged.
"I think I did that years ago, Spite."
"Very well. Shall we cast off?"
A short time later, the ship slipping easily just out from the shoreline, on a westward heading, they both stood at the port rail and observed the funeral procession's end, there at a new long barrow rising modestly above the surrounding hills. Crowds upon crowds of citizens ringed the mound. The silence of the scene, with the bells faint and distant, made it seem ethereal, like a painted image, solemn through the smoke haze. They could see the cart, the ox. Spite sighed.
"My sister once loved him, you know."
"Anamanda Rake? No, I didn't know that."
"His death marks the beginning."
"Of what?"
"The end, Cutter."
He had no response to that. A few moments drifted past.
"You said she loved him once. What happened?"
"He acquired Dragneepur. At least, I imagine that was the cause. She is well named, is my sister."
"Envy."
Cutter shot her a glance, thinking of her own name, this beautiful woman at his side, and wisely he said nothing. Nothing at all. The bell that wasn't there had finally stopped its manic ringing, and Celara was able to climb back onto the temple roof so that she could gaze out over the city. She could see the lake, where one lone ship had unfurled sails to ride the morning breeze. She knew those sails, and she tracked them for a time. Who was on board? Well, Spite for certain, and, if he'd any sense, Barathol. With smiling Chaur at his side, a giant child with his childish love that would never know betrayal, at least until the day, hopefully decades hence, when the blacksmith bowed to old age and took to bed for the last time. She could almost see him, his face, the deep wrinkles, the dimming of his dark eyes, and all the losses of his life falling away, veil by veil, until he ceased looking outward entirely. Chaur would not understand. What he would feel would crash blind as a boar in a thicket, crash right through him. It would be a dreadful thing to witness, to see the poor child tangled in the clutches of pain he could not understand, and loss he could not fathom. Who would care for him then? And what of dear Celara? Why was she not with them? She wished she had an answer to that. But she had come to certain truths about herself, destined, she now believed, to provide gentle comfort to souls in passing. A comforting bridge, yes, to ease the loneliness of their journey. She seemed doomed ever to open her arms to the wrong lover, to love fully yet never be so loved in return. It made her pathetic stock in this retinue of squandered opportunities that scrawled out the history of a clumsy life. Could she live with that, without plunging into self-pity? Time would tell, she supposed. Celara packed her pipe, struck sparks and drew deep. A sound behind her made her turn. As Barathol stepped close, one hand sliding up behind her head, leaned forward and kissed her. A long, deep, determined kiss. When he finally pulled away, she gasped, eyes wide, staring up into his own. He said,
"I am a blacksmith. If I need to forge chains to keep you, I will."
She blinked and then gave him a throaty laugh.
"Careful, Barathol. Chains bind both ways."
His expression was grave. Can you live with that?
Give me no choice.
Ride, my friends, the winds of love. There, beside a belfry where a man and a woman find each other, and out in the taut billows of sails where another man stares westward and dreams of sweet moonlight, a garden, a woman who is the other half of his soul. Gentle gust through a door, sweet sigh, as a guard comes home and is engulfed by his wife, who had suffered an eternal night of fears, but she holds him now and all is well, all is right, and children yell in excitement and dance in the kitchen. The river of grief has swept through Darujistan, and mourning waxes in its wake. There are lives to rebuild, so many wounds to mend. A bag of coins thumps onto the tabletop before a woman new to her blessed widowhood, and she feels as if she has awakened from a nightmare of decades. And this is, for her, a private kind of love, a moment for herself and no one else. Picker strides into the bar, and there waits Blend, tears in her eyes, and Samardev watches from a table, and she smiles, but that smile is wistful, and she wonders what doors wait for her, and which ones will prove unlocked, and what might lie beyond. And in a temple, Iskar Alpast blots dry the ink and crows over his literary genius. Magora looks on with jaded eyes, but is already dreaming of alliances with Sordico Quam. The Bokarala sit in a clump, exchanging wedding gifts. Two estate guards, after a busy night, burst into a brothel, only to find nobody there. Love will have to wait, and is anyone really surprised at their ill luck? At the threshold of a modest home and workshop, Tisera stands facing the two loves of her life. And, for the briefest of moments, her imagination runs wild. She then recovers herself and, in a light tone, asks, "Breakfast?" Torvald is momentarily startled. Ralik just smiles. There is a round man, circumference unending, stepping ever so daintily through rubble on his way back to the Phoenix Inn. It will not do to be a stranger to sorrow, if only to cast sharp the bright wonder of sweeter things. And so, even as he mourns in his own fashion with cupcakes, so too he sighs wistfully. Love is a city, yes indeed, a precious city, where 1,000,000 paths wend through shadow and light, through air stale and air redolent with blossoms, nose-wrinkling perfume and nose-wrinkling dung. And there is gold dust in the sewage and rebirth in the shedding of tears. And at last, we come to a small child, walking into a dueling school, passing through gilded streams of sunlight. And he halts 10 paces from a woman sitting on a bench, and he says something then, something without sound. A moment later, 2 imps trundle into view and stop in their tracks, staring at Harlow, and then they squeal and rush towards him. The woman looks up. She is silent for a long time, watching Mew and Hinty clutching the boy, and then a sob escapes her, and she makes as if to turn away. But Harlow will have none of that.
No, I've come home. That's what this is. It's me coming home.
She cannot meet his eyes, but she is weeping nonetheless. She waves a hand.
You don't understand, Harlow. That time. I have no good memories of that time. Nothing good came of it, nothing.
That's not true, he shouts, close to tears. That's not true. There was me.
As Silara now knew, some doors you cannot hold back. Bold as truth, some doors get kicked in. Stonny did not know how she would manage this, but she would. She would. And so she met her son's eyes in a way that she had never before permitted herself to do, and that pretty much did it. And what was said by Harlow in silence as he stood there in the moments before he was discovered? Why, it was this.
See, Bainisk, this is my mother.